Usually when we talk about building a world champion, whether that's in sports or business or just life, there is this kind of unstated expectation of magic.
Oh, absolutely. We love the magic.
Right. We love to imagine this mystical spark of talent, like a lightning bolt from the universe that just strikes a chosen few and propels them to greatness.
Yeah, we cling to that idea. I mean, we want to believe in destiny because honestly, it excuses the rest of
Oh,
us.
that is so true.
If greatness is just a magical lottery ticket, then, we don't have to take responsibility for not having it.
Exactly. But look behind the curtain of true, undeniable dominance, and that magic trick is completely exposed. We aren't looking at destiny at all.
Not even a little bit.
No. We are looking at a manufacturing process that is cold, mathematical, and entirely uncompromising. And today, for you listening, we are looking at the exact blueprints for that process.
It is a fascinating blueprint, too.
It really is. We're doing a deep dive into translated excerpts from a highly guarded text. It's called Non-Compromise Pendulum by Oleg Maltsev and Tom Patti.
Right.
And it is this incredibly rare, systematic breakdown of the legendary, unbeaten boxing coach, Cus D'Amato.
The architect himself.
Yeah, the guy who built three heavyweight world champions, including Mike Tyson, using these methodologies that were, well, largely kept in the shadows.
And before we really get into the mechanics of this, we have to establish the context here. I mean, yes, D'Amato operated in the brutal, chaotic world of boxing,
Very brutal.
but he did not design a system exclusively for fighting. The text makes it very clear he was designing a universal science of victory.
Okay, let's unpack that a bit.
Well, his ultimate objective was to engineer a human being to be completely invulnerable in any high-stakes environment.
Wow, any environment.
Any environment. You could take the exact blueprints we're about to discuss and apply them just as ruthlessly to dominating a boardroom or, surviving a hostile corporate takeover.
Or even winning an unwinnable case in a courtroom.
Exactly.
Okay, so our mission today is focusing purely on Chapter 4 of the text, which outlines D'Amato's character result model.
It's the core of the whole thing.
It really is. So we are going to map out his mathematical formula for building an invincible character. We'll examine the brutal internal war between what you want to do and what you will yourself to do.
The biggest war of all.
Yeah. And finally, we're going to break down how true champions win the fight before they ever even step foot into the arena.
So to start, the foundational premise of Chapter 4 is that to guarantee a specific external result, you have to first construct a very specific internal character.
Right. It starts from within.
Exactly. And the text states that leaders, and we mean the individuals who hold actual dominion and control over others, they differ from the masses in exactly two categories:
Skill and will.
skill and will. That's it.
Okay, well, let's tackle skill first because the authors don't just use that word casually. They get incredibly granular about what constitutes a real skill.
They really do. There's this fascinating linguistic collision highlighted in the text between the Russian mindset and the American mindset.
And it completely reframes how we think about capability, right?
Right. It alters the entire paradigm. So, in the Russian linguistic framework, a skill is viewed as a process.
Like an ongoing thing.
Yeah, it is intrinsically tied to time spent. Like,
Sure.
a Russian speaker conceptually says, I know how to do this.
Got it. It implies an ongoing action, like a familiarity developed through experience.
Exactly. But the American mindset, and specifically the militant mindset D'Amato demanded from his fighters, views skill not as a process, but as a completed transaction.
An absolute possessed object.
Yes, an American says, I have the skill.
I have it. It's mine.
Right. And the difference in phrasing sounds minor until you look at the mechanics of execution.
How so?
Well, if you only know how to do something, you're relying on ideal conditions to perform that process.
Oh, I see.
But if you possess the skill, if it is a tangible object you own, it functions like a loaded weapon in your pocket.
You just pull it out when you need it.
You don't need to warm up to it. You don't need ideal conditions. D'Amato required skills to be absolute possessions that could be deployed on demand.
Even in a state of total exhaustion or panic.
Exactly.
I have to push back on this rigid definition, though.
Sure, go ahead.
Because if we look at the real world, let's say a standard corporate office environment, doesn't personality carry a massive amount of weight?
Well,
I mean, we all know that highly charming coworker, the one who maybe isn't the most technically proficient at the actual job, but, they always know the right thing to say.
right. the office politician.
Yeah, they navigate office politics perfectly and they constantly get promoted.
Yeah.
Doesn't that kind of social maneuvering count as a currency in the hierarchy?
It's a great question, but the text actually addresses that exact illusion.
It's an illusion.
Total illusion. Charm and personality can absolutely serve as an acquisition strategy. Like, they can get you in the door or get you the promotion.
Okay.
But they're merely an illusion of safety when execution is suddenly demanded.
When push comes to shove.
Right. The authors use the example of an attorney to dismantle this. Imagine you hire a highly charismatic lawyer.
Okay.
You pay them a massive retainer because their charm convinced you they had the skill to win your case.
Ah, so they sold the illusion of the possessed skill.
Exactly. But once they get back to their office and look at the sheer complexity of your case, the reality sets in.
They don't actually know what to do.
They don't actually possess the required legal skill to execute. So what's the mechanical result of that lack of skill?
They panic.
They have to hire a colleague to help them.
Oh, right.
And they split your fee. But together, they still can't crack the precedent. So they hire a third expert, splitting the money even further.
Wow. So it doesn't matter how charming that initial lawyer was.
Nope. Without the actual possessed skill, they trigger this cascading failure of dependency. They become totally vulnerable to the people they had to hire.
And when you pull that concept out of an office and put it into a boxing ring, the reality becomes absolute.
It's undeniable in the ring.
Because you literally cannot bring a colleague into the ring with you.
No, you cannot.
You can't tag in your charming buddy because you don't know how to slip a left hook. The ring just strips away the illusion entirely.
Which is why there is only one world champion. You cannot share a championship title.
You either possess the solitary skill to survive and dominate, or you are rendered unconscious.
It's brutal, but it forces us to look at how skills define our exact position in any hierarchy.
Yeah. Let's talk about the hierarchy part.
Well, the authors draw a razor-sharp distinction between a commercial enterprise and a government bureaucracy.
Okay.
In a massive government structure, an individual can show up from 9 to 5, lack any tangible possessed skills, and still collect a paycheck.
Why is that?
Because the sheer mass of the bureaucracy absorbs their incompetence. The system just doesn't rely on their individual execution to survive.
Right, they can just hide inside the machinery of the state.
Exactly. But place that same unskilled person in a cutthroat commercial enterprise, and the dynamic flips entirely.
Because in a true commercial market, a lack of execution means the business bleeds revenue and dies.
The market crushes incompetence. In that environment, an expert with absolute possessed skills becomes irreplaceable.
You can't simply fire a master of execution and wish a replacement into existence.
No, because training takes time, and the market won't wait. Therefore, true skill is the only real currency of independence.
Okay, so if possessed skill is the engine of this fighting machine, what actually drives it? What puts the foot on the gas and forces the skill into action?
That is the million-dollar question.
And this brings us to the second pillar of D'Amato's leadership traits, which is will. Mm-hmm. And the text draws a massive, incredibly strict boundary between will and desire.
Yes. For most of us, those words are just interchangeable. We use them the same way.
Right. But here, they are entirely different species.
They separate them clinically. It's fascinating. Desire is fundamentally an emotion. It translates to the phrase, I want.
Okay.
It fluctuates based on your mood, your blood sugar, or, you know, the weather.
Yeah, it's fleeting.
Will, on the other hand, is the actual mechanical direction of effort applied toward a target. Will translates to the word should.
So, like, I might deeply desire to sleep in, but my will dictates that I should get up and work.
Exactly.
Think about how modern culture approaches goals right now.
Yeah.
We are constantly told to, like, find our passion or follow our desires.
All the time.
D'Amato's philosophy completely obliterates that advice.
It tears it down. The text gives the perfect mechanical example using Mike Tyson's early career.
Oh, this is a great example.
Think about a young, suddenly wealthy Mike Tyson. His desire, what his emotional state wanted to do, was to go out, party, and enjoy the fame.
I mean, who wouldn't?
Right. But his will, what he should do to maintain his dominance, was to isolate himself and sweat in the gym.
So D'Amato's genius as a psychological architect was his ability to force Tyson's will to constantly conquer his desire.
Yes. He built an environment where the should ruthlessly overpowered the want.
Because relying on desire to drive your execution is a catastrophic vulnerability.
It's the worst thing you can do. Desires are inherently fragile. Because they are emotional An opponent or a shifting environment can easily manipulate them.
The sources use two extreme examples to demonstrate the mechanics of how easily desires get flipped.
Right, the movie reference.
Yeah, first is a reference to the film Swordfish. A master hacker is brought in by a criminal syndicate, and he flat out states he does not want to do this seemingly impossible job.
His desire is at absolute zero.
Literally zero. But then the employer offers him $500,000 to hack the Department of Defense in 60 seconds while simultaneously putting a gun to his head.
That'll change your mind.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In a fraction of a second, his desire aligns perfectly with a required will. The environment manipulated his emotion, forcing the will to manifest.
And the second example removes the financial incentive entirely to show pure survival mechanics.
The maniac example.
The maniac example. You might be sitting on your couch, completely relaxed, thinking, I desperately do not want to fight a maniac with a knife today.
Your desire to avoid violence is at 100%.
But if a maniac kicks down your front door, the maniac's presence renders your desires completely irrelevant.
You don't have the luxury of waiting to, like, feel like fighting.
No, your will has to instantly take over the machinery of your body because your biological survival depends on it.
Right.
If you sit there waiting for the desire or the passion to fight a maniac to well up inside you, you are going to die.
But fighting that internal war every single day, the battle between what your emotions want to do and what your cold logic dictates you will yourself to do, has to be exhausting.
Oh, it is exhausting. And it is the primary source of human anxiety.
Really, anxiety.
Think about it. When your desires are constantly battling and shredding your skills because you cannot focus your effort in one direction, you lose your power potential.
You're divided.
You become weak. You live in a constant state of anxiety because deep down in your subconscious, you know you are not executing what you should be executing to guarantee your own survival.
So you become a victim of your own fluctuating emotions.
Exactly. D'Amato called these layers of emotion, ego, and fleeting desires the cabbage leaves.
The cabbage leaves. I love that visual.
He believed that society wrapped us in these cabbage leaves, making us soft and reactive.
So his entire training camp was designed to violently peel those leaves away, one by one.
Until nothing was left but the hard, impenetrable core.
Which brings us to the mathematical equation at the center of Chapter 4.
The big formula.
Yeah. D'Amato takes these two foundational components, the absolute currency of possessed skill and the directional force of will, and fuses them together. Will plus skill equals character.
Yes.
But it's important to clarify that D'Amato's not using the word character in the traditional sense here. He's not talking about, like, moral virtue or being a good citizen.
Not at all. In this specific methodology, character is a manufactured vehicle. It is a piece of technology built for the sole purpose of achieving a final result.
And D'Amato's required result for this character in the boxing world was incredibly precise.
Very specific.
A professional boxer has to find a way to hit, not get hit, and at the same time excite the crowd. That is the job description.
That's the result they need.
Right. If you remove the internal conflict of desires, meaning you peel away the cabbage leaves and align your effort purely with your will, and you arm that will with the undeniable currency of possessed skills, fear mathematically disappears.
Let's think about the mechanics of fear for a second. Why do we actually feel fear in a professional setting?
Because we might fail.
We feel it when we know we lack the skill to handle a looming obstacle, or when we are paralyzed because our desires conflict with our duties.
That makes perfect sense.
If you possess the ultimate skill to neutralize the obstacle, and your will is locked onto the target without any emotional distraction, the biological response of fear has no fuel.
It starves.
It starves completely. You operate as a machine built for a singular purpose.
Think about your own job for a second, to everyone listening. Visualize your daily routine.
Picture it.
If you could strip away your fluctuating desires, the desire to procrastinate, the desire for office approval, the desire to avoid conflict, and you just applied maximum directional will using absolute irreplaceable skills, what kind of character would you become in your industry?
You would be an unstoppable force.
Literally unstoppable. But having a powerful engine and a solid chassis doesn't mean you know how to win a race.
Right, the application.
Exactly. You have the character, but how does that character practically guarantee the result against a moving, thinking opponent?
This is where D'Amato transitioned from building tough guys to engineering tactical masters.
He armed them with what the text calls the science of victory. And there's a second formula introduced here.
Right. Theoretical training plus the science of victory equals class.
Class.
And in this context, class translates to ultimate mastery.
Let's break down the mechanics of that formula. Theoretical training is foundational, but it is entirely passive, right?
Yes. It's the difference between reading a military field manual on infantry tactics while sitting in a coffee shop versus actually taking enemy fire in a muddy trench.
That is a stark difference.
You could memorize every historical battle, you know the ballistic trajectory of every weapon, and be a walking encyclopedia of military theory.
Sure.
But knowing the theory of ballistics does not mean you know how to suppress an ambush and survive.
The theory gives you the vocabulary, but the science of victory is what bridges the gap between passive knowledge and violent execution.
Exactly. Let's return to the courtroom analogy from earlier.
Let's do it.
Theoretical law is what you use when you are sitting in a quiet library taking the bar exam. You know the statutes, you can cite the precedents.
All the book learning.
But when you step into an actual courtroom, the theoretical vacuum shatters. You are suddenly dealing with highly unpredictable variables.
Right. You have a judge who might be in a terrible mood. You have a hostile prosecutor actively trying to dismantle your credibility.
You have a jury of 12 unpredictable strangers bringing their own biases into the room.
So the science of victory isn't just knowing the law. What is it mechanically?
Mechanically, it is the tactical control of the chaotic environment.
Right.
It is the ability to recognize patterns in real time, anticipate the prosecutor's traps, manipulate the pacing of the trial, and maneuver the opposing counsel into a position where your possessed skill has a 100% success rate.
Wow. And D'Amato was legendary precisely because he took this rigid analytical science, this almost legalistic approach to controlling variables, and injected it into the chaotic, blood-soaked sport of heavyweight boxing.
He mapped the chaos.
He mapped it. And that leads to the core philosophical pillar of the entire text. D'Amato believed with absolute conviction that the fight is won before it starts.
It is the inevitable conclusion of his entire system.
Think about when the audience tunes in on a Saturday night and watches a spectacular first-round knockout.
Mm-hmm.
They cheer because they think they just witnessed a spontaneous, magical event.
But D'Amato viewed that knockout as nothing more than the final boring frame of a movie.
Boring. That's so wild to think about.
To him, it was. The audience is just watching the physical output of a mathematical equation that was solved months ago.
Because we culturally overvalue the spectacle. We worship the performance under the lights.
But the actual fight, the grueling mental conditioning, the violent peeling away of the cabbage leaves of desire, the meticulous installation of possessed skills, the strategic mapping of the opponent's psychological vulnerabilities.
All of that is entirely hidden from the crowd.
Yes. By the time those two fighters step through the ropes and the referee rings the bell, the outcome is already a mathematical certainty.
It has been determined by who successfully applied the superior science of victory in the dark.
The ring is just the printing press publishing the result of the preparation.
Printing press. That is perfectly said. If you have done the math correctly, you reach D'Amato's ultimate goal for a human being. You reach a state of absolute invulnerability.
Yes. When an opponent steps into the arena with you, they aren't really fighting a man anymore.
Right.
They are fighting an uncompromising, perfectly calibrated technology that you have adopted. And against that kind of technology, human emotion and frantic effort have absolutely no chance.
It is a profound and honestly an intimidating level of control.
It truly is.
So let's recap the mechanics of the journey we just took through Chapter 4. We decoded D'Amato's character result model. We learned that will plus skill equals character.
The essential formula.
Right. We explore the linguistic necessity of treating skill as a possessed object rather than a casual process. We examine the dangerous internal war between the emotions of what we want to do and the mechanical duty of what we will ourselves to do.
Peeling the cabbage leaves.
Peeling them away. And finally, we discovered that true champions win the war in the preparation phase, using the signs of victory to control the environment and guarantee the result before the bell even rings.
It is a systematic blueprint for removing luck, hope, and magic from the equation of success.
We started today by talking about our deep-seated desire to believe in destiny. We want success to be a magical lightning strike.
But the text we explored today proves that relying on your emotional desires and hoping for a spark of magic makes you completely vulnerable.
You become prey to yeah. anyone who shows up with a cold, scientifically constructed plan.
Exactly.
So I want to leave you with one final thought to analyze as you look at your own life. Look at the absolute biggest goal you are chasing right now. the one thing you want more than anything else.
Really think about it.
Are you currently trying to achieve it based purely on the fluctuating emotional motivation of your desires?
All right.
Or are you relying on the cold, uncompromising science of victory that practically guarantees you have already won before you even start?
The machinery you choose to build will dictate the result you have to live with.